You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Nick, thank you very much for joining me, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's jump into it because I hit you up last week and asked if you would come on to talk about all the research you've been doing as it pertains to vaccines across the spectrum, pun intended, from COVID vaccines to early childhood vaccines. But first, for the audience, I'm sitting down with Nicholas Holscher, who's an epidemiologist and administrator at the McCullough Foundation. He earned his Bachelor of Science from Oakland University Honors College in 2020, graduating with Institutional and Departmental Honors, and his Master of Public Health with a specialization in epidemiology from the University of Michigan School of Public Health in 2024. Nick has contributed to more than 20 peer-reviewed scientific studies on COVID-19, vaccine injury syndromes, SARS-CoV-2, H5N1 avian influenza, and the determinants of autism spectrum disorder. So you've been on the tip of the spear as it pertains to all the data that the government and big pharma industry players don't want the masses to get access to in terms of how different vaccines may be negatively affecting individuals around the world. And I think it's important work. As I was telling you before we hit record, this has been a recurring theme on this show for the last 5 years. I'm worried that the powers that be want to sweep this under the rug and not make it apparent to people what is happening. And I think it's become very clear to me that a discussion needs to be had about vaccines broadly and how they play into our lives. And we're talking about where to start. And I think since we've covered COVID vaccine quite extensively over the last 5 years, it would make sense to sort of get an update there and see what the latest on the research is saying.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, so we'll start off with the COVID shot. And I'd just bring up a paper we recently uploaded to the preprint server. It's currently undergoing peer review. This was about a month ago. But what we identified was we had one of Dr. McCullough's patients. He is the single most tested human being for vaccine injury to date. He had over 200 tests done, laboratory tests and imaging studies. He visited over 200 specialists to find out what was wrong with him. And he visited the ER like 40 times for severe chest pains. So what happened was he received 3 Pfizer mRNA injections. And he subsequently developed myocarditis, long vaccine syndrome, multi-system long vaccine syndrome. He had a pulmonary embolism, neurological disturbances, dermatological disturbances. So he had developed Grover's disease, these kind of lesions on the skin, and many other things, hearing loss. And, you know, his whole body began to fail. So he went through those hundreds of tests and they ruled out everything except one thing, which was obviously clear from the beginning. It was the vaccine. And so then he shipped probably over 10 tissue samples and blood samples to a lab in Germany, and they looked for vaccine components. And by the way, this was 3.5 years after his last shot. So we identified messenger RNA, Pfizer messenger RNA in his circulating exosomes 3.5 years after his last shot. These are kind of these circulating bubbles, these messenger molecules that deliver, you know, different instructions throughout the body. And we found the Pfizer mRNA was still there. But we also found plasmid DNA from the manufacturing process in his skin tissue 3.5 years after his last shot. And that included the SV40 segment, which is cancer promoting, as well as the spike expression region of these plasmids, as well as the origin of replication part, the ORI. So all segments of the plasmids were embedded in his skin. And lastly, we found spike protein was still in his skin 3.5 years after his last shot and circulating in his blood and exosomes. And this was after a battery of serial testing. So it wasn't just one test that found these. It was one test. You know, 2 months later, another test. 2 months later, another test. And each time we confirmed the vaccine components. And lastly, infection was completely ruled out. He had about 5 antibody tests looking for the nucleocapsid antibodies, which indicates you were infected. Each time they were negative. And when we stained his tissue for spike protein, and we also stained it for nucleocapsid, which would indicate the spikes from the virus. There was no nucleocapsid in the skin either. So we basically confirmed that mRNA injection components can last in the human body for at least 3.5 years.
Yeah. It's insane. It's like, and that's one thing I really want to dive into. You mentioned SV40 still being present. And that's something I've talked a lot about with Drs. Kevin McKernan and Jessica Rose, who co-authored a paper basically highlighting that this SV40 cancer accelerant was found in the Pfizer vaccine specifically, I believe Moderna as well. And again, I think it's a conversation that needs to be had. I think there's a lot of individuals out there who, I don't want to say they have cognitive dissonance, but they have their head in the sand, almost don't want to admit that these vaccines that were pushed on the market and pushed on individuals, mandated in many cases, are doing as much harm as they are. And so, I mean, just a few follow-ups there. How representative is this one patient for everybody who took these vaccines? Obviously, you have a very good data set with one individual. What can we draw from that in terms of the broader public and whether or not this is playing out similarly in many other individuals? Is this a unique sort of drastic case of this lingering for more than 3.5 years? And then just follow on with the SV40 specifically, tying it to the increase in turbo cancers and cancer incidents that we're seeing throughout the country and throughout the world. How bad do you think the problem is, and how bad do you think it will get in the future?
So the problem is we don't know how many people will have this vaccine material in them still years later, because nobody's looking. The government's not looking. The regulatory agencies aren't looking. Nobody's looking. And the only labs that can test for this are in Europe. So, you know, we've been left out to dry. And so now we're left with kind of getting these single case reports and, you know, finding it out ourselves. And so we found it in this guy. We have another case report that we haven't published yet, but it was very unfortunate. A young man, his mother called us, you know, crying because her son should not have died this young. He received 2 Pfizer shots and he developed a heart tumor, what's called a primary cardiac sarcoma. And he received another booster and then it metastasized to his brainstem. And he died a slow and agonizing death, unfortunately. And then the tissue samples, the tumor samples from his brain tissue were sent to this Germany lab. And they found a vaccine plasmid DNA in the tumor. So the SV40 and the spike encoding regions. So, and that was, you know, that was about a year after. So, but then there's also other papers that have come out. One was a Yale study, and they looked in a bunch of long vaccine patients, and they found the spike protein in an individual over 700 days after his last shot. So, you know, over 2 years. So, you know, that kind of corroborates, you know, our case. And then there's many other papers that have found it months later, because that's about as far as they looked. So, you know, there have been other studies that have found prolonged persistence of this material, but we cannot make, you know, we cannot draw a prevalence from these, unfortunately. We need, you know, larger scale studies. But I would suspect if an individual received a messenger RNA vaccine and they developed long vaccine syndrome, so they became very tired, sickly, brain fog, you know, post-exertional fatigue. So they go exercise and now they can't, you know, they cannot oxygenate as well anymore. They're out of breath. You know, if you develop that and you still have those symptoms years later, you know, I would suspect it's possible you may still have some of those components. But again, we don't know. Now, you mentioned the turbo cancers. We published another paper late last year where we actually identified genomic integration of vaccine plasmid DNA in a human being. And so this was a 31-year-old woman who developed stage 4 bladder cancer after 3 doses of mRNA injection. And we looked in her circulating tumor DNA, and we literally found a segment of that DNA plasmid, the spike encoding segment, was fused in her chromosome 19 in a what's called a non-safe harbor region. So it integrated in a region you do not want something to integrate in. It's what's called a transcriptionally active area. And that probably explains why that, you know, she developed a very rare and aggressive turbo cancer. So, yeah, it appears that that plasmid DNA can get in through, we don't know the exact mechanism. We believe this particular case was not from what's called reverse transcription of mRNA to DNA. We believe this may have been a form of insertional mutagenesis. Foreign DNA getting into these what are called DNA double strand breaks. So she may have had some, you know, some fractured DNA circulating, and then the vaccine just gets in those breaks. But regardless, and now in the at the population level for cancers, we see it very clearly. In fact, CDC data shows, CDC Wonder data specifically, shows actually that since 2021, since the mass mRNA injection program began, there's been over 136,000 excess cancer deaths. So 136,000 more cancer deaths than normal since the vaccines rolled out in the United States alone. So people are dying of cancers way more. And but there's also lastly two population studies that confirm this. One was in South Korea and one was in Italy. They had both of them 8.7 million people combined. They both compared vaccinated populations to the unvaccinated. And the vaccinated suffered increased risks of 7 major cancers, including colorectal, bladder, breast, prostate, thyroid, gastric. So all of these cancers were up. Overall, cancer hospitalizations were up. And both mRNA and viral vector platforms, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, appear to be carcinogenic. So it's a very worrisome situation, and it's very clear that these shots appear to be one of the largest carcinogenic exposures in history.
Two follow-ups there. I had Dr. McKernan on to talk about a study out of Japan that basically highlighted the distribution of cancer types after the emergence of the COVID vaccine changed drastically within Japan. Are we seeing that data in the US? And then quick follow-up, just like, what does it mean if these things are carcinogenic?
Well, I believe it was, I don't remember the exact cancers that were up in that Japan paper. I believe it might've been leukemia and lymphoma. Those are definitely up. There's a military data set that shows, I believe leukemias were up in service members who were mandated to get these shots. But the thing is it ranges so many different types of cancer because it appears the mechanism of inducing cancer, this is why we call it carcinogenic. And so basically carcinogenic means a product that causes cancer, right? And so now the mechanism behind the mRNA induced cancers is likely actually, most people have cancers, you know, a small number of cancer cells in their body, you know, at any given time, but their immune system keeps it in check, right? It's functioning properly. And when you have adequate T cells, when your immune system's not dysfunctional, when you don't have hyperinflammation, you know, your body can help keep those in check. And when you introduce the mRNA injection, it literally degrades, downregulates your T cell counts. So all of a sudden, you don't have the cells needed in adequate amounts to protect against cancer or even other infections. But also, we found in a paper that the mRNA shots turn off and downregulate tumor suppressor genes, P53 and BRCA. So when those genes go down, that means your body cannot surveil for cancers as well anymore. And these can start to kind of prop up throughout the body. Now, like I mentioned, some people already have some cancers they may not be aware of. And so you get the shots, then all of a sudden those cancers you had that were, you know, may have taken 20, 30 years to kind of become, you know, clinically manifested. Now they're going to just propagate right away, you know, in a few weeks. And then all of a sudden you'll have these large tumors in various organ systems. You know, we know the mRNA does get into all the vital organ systems through the lipid nanoparticle delivery system. And so we may see tumors anywhere in the body. And that's why, you know, we're finding cardiac tumors. I mean, those very, very rare. And that's why we're finding brain tumors, glioblastomas. You know, we're finding the blood cancers, leukemia. We're finding reproductive cancers, you know, in the ovaries, ovarian cancer. And so, yeah, there's not one single cancer, I would say, is, you know, definitively caused by these shots. It's basically just down-regulating the body's immune capacity.
Mm-hmm. It's infuriating. Where do you think we stand today in terms of, I mean, I think anybody on X or anybody who's paying attention on X and who's been listening to this show is aware. Do you think the sort of public perception about this stuff is shifting towards a direction that would make you more confident that we could get to some accountability and justice here? Or are you worried that this is successfully going to be swept under the rug?
Well, it's actively being swept under the rug, unfortunately, because there was many chances to end this disastrous program. We thought it was going to happen when RFK got in. They made some steps such as, you know, recommending it only for so-called high-risk individuals. But we have to remember that's still, you know, six-month-olds can still get the shots if they're so-called high-risk. Which is ridiculous. There are no 6 month olds at high risk of COVID. And then they were going to put a black box warning on it. FDA internal scientists said they should put a black box warning on it. And then FDA leadership refused to, and they admitted that Marty Makary did on TV. And so, yeah, we're seeing, you know, they're trying to sweep it under the rug. But the positive thing is that now a majority of Americans believe that the COVID shots caused mass deaths, according to a Rasmussen survey. 56% of American voters, you know, do think that the shots are extremely deadly. So, you know, we are in the majority now, the American public. And so the minority is these regulatory agencies. And the remaining small proportion of the population still receiving boosters. But so there's many different angles. Many different states are currently introducing legislation to try and ban these for either everybody or for kids and pregnant women. Many of them have been shot down by compromised lawmakers, unfortunately. But there is a bill recently that passed the committee vote. I recently testified. And so this bill would, in Idaho, would ban the mRNA shots, at least for children and pregnant women. and it will go to the House floor shortly for a vote. So, you know, we're seeing movements there. But, you know, I'm hopeful that we will at least see some states ban these for the most vulnerable, but they need to be banned for everybody because they're lying about them. They're saying they're not telling people the risks. It's still an experiment and it needs to be stopped.
Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20.
Sup, freaks. Up next, the Bitcoin Scaling Conference, where Bitcoin developers meet institutional capital, is coming to New York next month. Join Bitcoiners from Blockstream, Chaincode, Brink, and more at the Can't Miss Summit at the intersection of Bitcoin tech and finance. This conference has one of the best signal-to-noise ratios, and that's why I'll be joining Blockspace's third annual Bitcoin Tech Conference on April 16th at the New York Times Center in Midtown Manhattan. There's only room for 200 attendees, and they've already sold more than 100 tickets of their open spots. So you've only got a few weeks to get your travel plans in order for New York. With the ticket, you get access to the best programming in Bitcoin tech, from BitVM to BitChat, catered lunch, and access to the PubKey After Party. Wearing the hat, PubKey After Party. Up next is where builders meet capital, founders find funding, and companies source top talent. Plus, meet institutional investors and developers from BlackRock, H.C. Wainwright, and Bitcoin Infrastructure Corp. If you're at a venture fund or another finance firm, this is the event to learn more about the quantum computing, bleeding edge Bitcoin tech, and topics that will define Bitcoin's futures. Go to opnext.dev for tickets and use the code TFTC to get 25% off a general admission or VIP ticket to the event. Again, that's opnext.dev, code TFTC for 25% off a ticket. I'll see you there.
In terms of studies that you would want to see done to make the evidence even clearer than I think we both believe it is at this point, you mentioned that people simply just aren't looking for this stuff via studies that are sort of targeted towards identifying this. Is there anything in the works in that direction?
Towards identifying these materials in people, like the persistence of it, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, we're at the McCullough Foundation. We are doing more of these studies. We're finding more patients and we plan to test them to see if they still have this circulating vaccine material years later. So we're going to continue to do that. We're not sure of any large scale studies at the moment that are doing this, unfortunately. You know, we would like to do that, but, you know, that's going to require large amounts of resources, time, money, and effort. And, you know, we don't have billions of dollars like, you know, the CDC has, you know, unfortunately. So, yeah, if people want to help out, you know, you can go to McCulloughFoundation.com. But, yeah, you know, we'd like to do larger studies. Nobody's that we're aware of is planning on doing them at the moment, but a study did come out 2 weeks ago that did look in placentas of vaccinated pregnant women. And they actually found that 30% or 37% of women who were vaccinated and not infected had spike protein in their placenta. Some of them had the spike protein in the placenta, even though they were vaccinated before pregnancy. And so that range, that, you know, that's many, many months then, that means, because they went through the whole pregnancy, still had spike protein, but they were vaccinated before. So that could be about a year of persistence. And there was a lot of patients in that study, I believe about 60 of them. So that did just come out. But yeah, I'm not aware of any others.
No. I mean, you mentioned states moving to pass legislation that would prevent some part of the population from getting the COVID vaccines. But it's funny, I live in a state, Pennsylvania, where our governor, Josh Shapiro, shifting gears here towards the childhood vaccine schedule, seems pretty determined to sort of go over the top of RFK and the current the current administration in terms of their desire to basically make it so parents aren't forced to go along with the childhood vaccine schedule. And this is something as a father of three young children, something that I'm very, very passionate about, particularly right now, because it scares the hell out of me. But I think this is another big topic, just vaccines more broadly and specifically the childhood schedule. It's coming into question for many reasons. Like, number one, do these children need these particular vaccines that they're considering how young they are? I think Hep B is the number one example of something that just does not make any sense, considering it's a sexually transmitted disease or a disease you get from dirty heroin needles. It doesn't make sense to give it to somebody who's less than an hour old. But then you have the whole question of is there a causal link between the vaccine schedule and autism? And I think it's becoming clear, at least to me, that there may be a link here, and something that we should be discussing pretty vigorously as a country and as a broader society.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So the first thing to understand about the childhood vaccines is that not one of the currently recommended childhood vaccines, not one, was licensed by the FDA based on a double-blind, long-term, placebo-controlled trial. So what that means is, for all the vaccines that the doctors will tell you to give your child, none of them were tested against a placebo before licensure. So they were tested against another vaccine that also didn't undergo a placebo trial. So basically, they're untested, right? You cannot find any sort of risks when you compare vaccinated children to vaccinated children who are vaccinated with the previous version of the vaccine. You have to compare it to a placebo group that receives saline, an inert placebo. So that wasn't done. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is we conducted a extraordinarily comprehensive analysis on the causes of autism that was completed last October. And what we did was 82 pages, over 300 references, and we looked at every possible cause of autism. We identified, basically without a doubt, well, first of all, we identified about 136 vaccine-related studies that looked at vaccines and neurodevelopmental outcomes. 107 of those found that there was a positive link between these vaccines and neurodevelopmental disorders and autism, spanning case report evidence, mechanistic evidence, so in animals, and human epidemiological evidence. So there's only a small subset of studies that look that claim there's no association, and not one of those has an unvaccinated control group, not one. And so it's absolutely ridiculous. So, and then the big thing is, though, there's 12 studies that compare, or now actually there's been 13 studies that compare vaccinated to unvaccinated children. And in every single one, the vaccinated children were far sicker. Every single one across every single domain they look at, including autism, including other neurodevelopmental disorders, ADHD, tics, speech delays, learning disabilities, and other chronic diseases, autoimmune diseases, diabetes, skin disorders, asthma, et cetera, all worse in the vaccinated children when there's an actual unvaccinated control group. And then we looked, and then we found these other possible causes: older parents, premature delivery, siblings with autism, other environmental exposures, in utero exposure to drugs, you know, SSRIs, Tylenol, et cetera, you know, glyphosate exposures, heavy metals, antibiotics. We looked at all this stuff, but nothing could explain the drastic rise in autism since 1986 other than the vaccines, because in 1986 was the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, where vaccine makers got full liability protection. And so there was only about 10 doses, 12 doses, and then the act passes. They get liability protection, and then all of a sudden it shoots up to 72 doses by age 18. And, you know, they don't face any penalties if children are damaged. And so that was a, you know, they were licking their chops, these vaccine makers, shot out all these untested shots, and then that tracked perfectly. Vaccine doses with autism cases tracks perfectly for those last, you know, 50 or 40 years. And so vaccines appear to most definitely be the single most dominant risk factor, modifiable risk factor for autism, because it can be changed, right? You don't have to give the kids vaccines. You don't have to give the kids vaccines when they're, you know, 6 month old infants or when they're 2 years old. You don't have to do that. That can change. You can modify that. And then, you know, some of these other factors would explain some of these cases, but not an epidemic. Glyphosate, for example, you know, that could probably be contributing by some degree to some of these cases, but not all of them. And so, yeah, it's quite clear. We fed the study into all of the AI engines, Grok, ChatGPT, Gemini, and we asked it, do vaccines cause autism based on our study? And all three of the AI LLMs said that yes. Yes, vaccines cause autism. And so, you know, it's very clear at this point in time.
So what is it about the vaccines that causes the autism? Is it the heavy metals, aluminum, mercury? Have we figured that out yet?
It's a combination of all of them. First, everybody assumed it was mercury, and that was very plausible. There's lots of laboratory evidence when they inject these animals with mercury, it just causes brain damage and encephalopathy, so brain dysfunction and autism-like behaviors. And there's multiple human epidemiological studies looking at, back when the hepatitis B shots contained mercury, it increased autism risk by like 300%. So mercury was one, but now mercury's taken out. We still see autism. But it's not just mercury, because there was also aluminum in these shots. And that's another target that appears to elicit neuronal damage or brain damage. It gets into the central nervous system through the injections, through the vaccines. And there's studies that have looked in brain tissue of autistic individuals. They literally found higher levels of aluminum in their brains. And, you know, and it was pathological brain tissue. So the aluminum was doing damage. In the animals, it does the same thing. They inject the rats with aluminum. They have autism-like behaviors. And there's been multiple other studies that have found increased risks of neurodevelopmental disorders with higher aluminum exposure. But again, it's not just aluminum. It's the whole construct, everything in the vaccine. It's the aluminum, the polysorbate 80, the neomycin, which is a neurotoxic antibiotic, the formaldehyde traces in these shots, but also just the fact of itself, the vaccine antigens, right? The killed viruses, that combining all of that and injecting six of them at a time into a you know, 6 month old infant or 2 year old baby does overwhelm their detoxification pathways. They cannot cope with these materials at one given time. And then unfortunately it does reach the central nervous system. And this is now shown in the case reports that we document in that study, where the children, they get the six shots, sometimes even one shot, two shots, three shots, and then they develop a high fever. As this vaccine material starts to circulate in their body, you know, is reacting to this foreign material, and they get the high fever. But once it gets too high, they have a febrile seizure, right? They start seizing up, unfortunately. And then they recover from the seizure, but after they recover, they're not the same. They've regressed developmentally. They forget words. Unfortunately, sometimes they forget even how to use the bathroom. They literally regress, you know, and forget everything. And then That's the pathway usually that is seen in the clinical reports. But yeah, those materials get in, they get into the central nervous system, cause what's called encephalitis, brain inflammation. And when you have brain inflammation for an extended period of time, and then you have the seizures, that can cause brain damage. And a lot of these cases are a result of vaccine-induced brain damage.
Yeah, it's infuriating. And I mean, this is almost hard to say. It seems a bit uncouth, but some people would be lucky if that was the extent of the effects of these vaccines. I think some more research that you've done, at least following your ex account, it seems like the whole idea of sudden infant death syndrome, you can make a case that part of that, what is driving that, is the vaccines as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We uploaded a paper, a study, again, to the preprint server last month. That's also undergoing peer review. It was deleted by ResearchGate, by the way. They claimed it was a threat to public security and public health. So this study angered a lot of people, very strangely, given how we looked at the vaccine adverse event reporting system. You know, this is official CDC, FDA data. We queried that system for MMR and MMRV vaccine death reports. And we found over 300 MMR and MMRV vaccine deaths among infants and toddlers. So large numbers of deaths shortly following the shots in these children. Most of the deaths occurred within 2 weeks of the vaccine. Most of the deaths were among one-year-olds to one-and-a-half-year-olds right when they get these shots. And the deaths involved sudden infant death syndrome, a large proportion were classified as SIDS, but also cardiac arrests, seizures, and encephalitis and fevers. So the clinical presentations were matching up with vaccine reactions, unfortunately leading to their demise. But the shocking part is of this studies, we also looked at measles deaths. How many measles deaths were there since 1995 in the U.S.? There was 7 of them. So, but also since 1995, there was about 2,600% more MMR and MMRV vaccine death reports than measles deaths since 1995 in the United States. So the vaccines are killing far more children than measles infection, far more. And VAERS is underreported by a factor of a conservative factor of about 30, but actually it's probably over 100, less than 1% of vaccine adverse events are reported to VAERS. So, it could be 80,000% higher, more vaccine deaths than measles deaths. So it's very serious mortality signal with these shots. And it's corroborated by a study by Hooker and colleagues from Children's Health Defense a few months ago. They found infants vaccinated 2-month-old infants compared to unvaccinated 2-month-old infants, the vaccinated infants had a 68% higher odds of dying in the following month than the unvaccinated infants. So that it's corroborating now. Unfortunately, these shots appear to be increasing mortality risks.
When I was told fearmongers like yourself are spreading misinformation, which is leading people not to get these vaccines. And that's why measles is reemerging in the United States.
Yeah. Lots of trolls are claiming, we're lying or spreading dangerous misinformation, but we're not, because unfortunately the program that they are so much advocating for, the MMR vaccines, that we now verified are killing way more children than measles. So they're advocating for a death program at this point. If they want measles vaccination still, perhaps we should split it up. Don't give the MMR anymore. Just give the measles shot, right? That'll reduce the number of deaths from these shots, most likely. But we don't see any of that. All we see is just, these defamation and fear tactics saying measles is, the scariest disease ever. We have to remember, in the 60s, there was measles parties. There's a far less case fatality rate than the flu. It's very mild, very treatable at this point in time. at least by doctors that know what they're doing. Not the measles deaths that occurred in 2025. Most of those were from medical malpractice that has now been verified, mistreatment. They didn't treat them right. But yeah, you know, again, it's very obvious a vaccine should never kill more than the disease. And since that's the case, alternatives are needed, right? We have to start discussing it. We cannot shy away from it.
What's up, freaks? When you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their motto is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. It always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
What's up, freaks? This rip is brought to you by our good friends at Silent. Silent creates everyday Faraday gear that protects your hardware. We're in Bitcoin. We have a lot of hardware that we need to secure. Your wallet emits signals that can leave you vulnerable. You want to pick up Silent's gear, put your hardware in that. I have a tap signer right here. I got the Silent card holder, replaced my wallet. I was using Ridge Wallet because it's secured against RFID signal jacking. Silent, the card holder, does the same thing. It's much sleeker, fits in my pocket much easier. I also have the Faraday phone sleeve, which you can put a hardware wallet in. We're actually using it for our keys at the house too. There's been a lot of robberies. They have essential Faraday slings, Faraday backpacks. It's a Bitcoin company. They're running on a Bitcoin standard. They have a Bitcoin treasury. They accept Bitcoin via Strike. So go to slnt.com/TFTC to get 15% off anything, or simply just use the code TFTC when shopping at slnt.com. Patented technology, special operations approved. It has free shipping as well. So go check it out.
It's completely disconcerting and disheartening because, I mean, let's just go through the whole range. We started COVID, we're at childhood, but I've been following you. You've been talking about later in life, if you get the flu vaccine and you keep getting your boosters for anything else that you've been vaccinated for, it's also increasing Alzheimer's and dementia. And so and we can get into exactly what's happening there. But I think just like the broader picture I wanted to help paint by bringing you on is that it seems like just across the whole complex of this vaccine industry, there seems to be alarm bells going off that need to be confronted. And it spans the whole life cycle of a human at this point.
Yeah, you're right. Even the adult vaccines now, we're seeing very serious signals with. The largest single study that ever looked at vaccines and dementia risk had 13 million people in it, found that adults who receive vaccines, including flu, pneumococcal shots, shingles shots, other sorts of shots, if they receive them compared to the adults that don't receive these vaccines, the vaccinated adults faced 38% higher risks of dementia and 50% higher risk of Alzheimer's dementia. And the risk lasts for about a decade in that study. And it was a very robust study. They accounted for every variable you could think of. And they tried to dampen the association through these subgroup analyses, and they couldn't fully dampen it. Every single analysis they did with the 13 million people, the vaccinated adults had higher risks of dementia. But the key thing is the more it was dose dependent, the more doses that these adults received, the higher the risk of dementia became. So that's a signal of a possible causal relationship when you have dose dependency. And so this is very worrisome. So it's not just the childhood vaccines. Now we have a dementia crisis in adults, Alzheimer's crisis. It's skyrocketing. Millions upon millions of people's grandparents, parents are suffering from these debilitating neurocognitive diseases. And this may be one large contributing factor.
Yeah. What do you think is really driving the sort of boxing out of having the conversation? Is it because I've had Ed Dowd on, and particularly as it pertains to the COVID vaccine, he makes a case that like we'll never get accountability for the COVID vaccine because all the large Fortune 500 companies and any employer that mandated these will immediately succumb to a flurry of litigation and suits against them from employees that were mandated to take the shots and were then harmed. And he makes the case that they're simply just like an economic security argument that you can't admit it because then everybody's liable and that would completely destroy the economy because all these companies would be forced to pay out lawsuits. And that's one. And the other is obviously the ongoing profitability of these vaccines for the big pharma industry participants. It's a gravy train. It's a money printer. And I just think we have this principal agent problem that exists right now that nobody seems to want to confront, and we just need to bludgeon it and have the conversation.
Yeah, no, we have to have the conversation, but you're right. You know, if they come out and say the COVID shots are deadly, dangerous, cancerous, carcinogenic, neurotoxic, cardiotoxic, et cetera, and they pull them off the market, yeah, there will be a tidal wave of lawsuits. You know, all the individuals involved in pushing these experimental gene transfer injections will probably go out of business because so many have been injured. Millions in America have been injured, disabled, or killed. And, but you know what? You know, we got to do something. And those who have made these choices to mandate these products to their employees, you know, perhaps they should go out of business. Now, I'm not an economics guy, so I probably would be catastrophic, you know, for the economy, but we have to do something. You know, there's lots, you know, no accountability has happened yet for anything, for the gain of function activities, and then going down to the mandates of these shots that have resulted in all of these casualties. Nobody's been held accountable, and there really needs to be a truth and reconciliation process to, you know, put this behind us and get over it. But unfortunately, yeah, it appears it's being swept under the rug, and they hope everybody will forget about it.
I'm smirking here, but it's because I'm just reminded of something that broke a couple of weeks ago, but the fact that Lyme disease was probably created in a lab in Plum Island, and many people are worried about alpha-gal syndrome from the Lone Star tick that's been spreading throughout the country for the last 5 to 10 years, and I was smirking and it made me think of that because you mentioned gain of function. Like the government literally funded COVID that released from the lab one way or another. Who knows exactly how, but it just seems like we are up against this almost demonic force in the state, the regulators, and the big pharma industry participants who, from everything I've seen, observed, been paying attention to for the last 5 years, it seems like there's a concerted effort to make us sicker and more dependent on the system, which is crazy. It's just like it's an inversion of what these institutions are supposed to represent. They're supposed to be looking out for our best interest, particularly as it pertains to our health. And example after example, we're only just scratching the surface in the first 45 minutes of this conversation points to that they're actively trying to harm us. That's the only conclusion I can come to.
Yeah, it appears they are. Unfortunately, it appears they are actively trying to harm the population because, you know, all the evidence, they have all the evidence. There's thousands of studies now, at least with the COVID shots, showing immense casualties and harm, and yet they still give them to 6-month-olds. So that appears to me as being intentional because why else would they be doing it? I don't think it's just money. Money is a part of it. But, you know, there are individuals entrenched with relationships, again, with these government entities, such as Gates Foundation, you know, World Economic Forum, et cetera. that would like to see a reduction in population number. And so, you know, we have to start looking into those activities. Yeah, you know, we had the Epstein files come out last month, finding Gates and Epstein were planning pandemics back in 2011 up till 2017. And then 2019 was Event 201. So, you know, these profiteering activities need federal investigation. But, you know, again, our, you know, we still haven't seen any accountability. So I don't know if there will be investigations into those entities and those relationships, but there needs to be.
The Malthusians are in control. It's pretty crazy. What made you so passionate about doing all this work? How'd you get into this line of work?
I got into this because in 2020, I witnessed the disaster. And from right away, I was like, something's wrong. This isn't right. You know, there's going to be some coordinated effort to inject people with an injection. I even made a Reddit post about it back then when I saw the article of what these so-called vaccines were going to be. They already were telling people the mechanism. And so, you know, I wanted to get in and make a difference, you know, and to do that, there was only a few avenues. And one of them, one of the best ones that I concluded would be great was to go into public health to make a difference as quickly as possible, do the research, investigate the harms from what has occurred. And so I went to University of Michigan for epidemiology training, got my master's of public health. But while I was there, I was lucky enough to get an internship with Dr. McCullough for a research project, which was a systematic review of autopsy findings and deaths after the vaccine. So he did that, took a few months to scavenge the entire literature for these autopsy cases, and there was 325 of them. We proved a causal link between the COVID vaccines and death. And so I presented that at University of Michigan. All the professors, you know, many professors, they wouldn't even look at me during my presentation. They would walk right past me, pretend I didn't exist. But I was also warned by some professors that I would have no career if I continued to do that research. But I did it anyways. And since then, I graduated and then have just been cranking out the studies at the McCullough Foundation, uncovering what exactly has happened to humanity.
Was the reaction, not only the reaction from your professors, but what you came to find through your research, was it shocking? Were you expecting the results that you got, or were they underwhelming, overwhelming?
No, I was expecting it because, you know, again, 325 deaths occurring shortly after the vaccine. Nobody did a paper like this before where they collected all of these deaths. And, you know, I was already under the impression that the shots were, you know, inducing large numbers of deaths in individuals. And, you know, it was proven right in the autopsy evidence. Like, these individuals, most of them died within a week of the shot, and they died of sudden death, sudden cardiac arrest, pulmonary embolisms, strokes, myocarditis, and multi-organ failure, right? And so, you know, a week after the shot, we concluded that 73.9% of these deaths with the autopsies were due to the vaccine. So, yeah, it was very strong evidence. And it should have necessitated an immediate FDA class one recall because, you know, you're not supposed to have deadly products being injected into the general public, but that never happened. It was published in Forensic Science International. It was there for about 2 weeks. It became the number one most accessed research paper in the world, according to the Observatory of International Research. And then a week later, it was illegally retracted. They claimed, oh, some anonymous people came and said that your conclusions are not supported by your methods. And then they just retracted it after we paid, you know, $5,000 to publish it. I don't even know if they refunded us. And so that happened. And then it was published a second time After another round of peer review in another journal. So, you know, everybody can go find it now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's been another eye-opening sort of realization, conversations with individuals like yourself who are on the cutting edge and tip of the spear of identifying all this stuff is the corruption of the peer review process. And another thing that the Epstein files are sort of highlighting is that was created by Ghislaine Maxwell's father. And I mean, it's just laughable. I think pub smear is a big meme in your community these days. And it just blows my mind that you can have this part of the industry based around research that has so much control. And it seems to be so obviously corrupted with perverse incentives.
Yeah, it's dangerously corrupted. It appears to be a journal cartel, this conglomerate of all these major publishers, Elsevier, Sage Journals, Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine. All of these top publishers appear to be compromised and want to, and intentionally were suppressing information that was against the vaccines. You won't find one paper in the top journals, Lancet, JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, not one paper that's critical of the vaccines, because half of the editors receive money from pharma. I mean, and even half the peer reviewers receive money from pharma. And the editors make the final call, and they'll just reject the papers that are critical against the shots. And so this is absolutely terrible. But when we do get papers in, through, you know, a journal under the umbrella of these major publishers, you know, we'll have a favorable editor in chief. We'll get a good dice roll with the peer reviewers, because it's just a dice roll, by the way, whoever agrees with you or not. And we get it published, you know, then the leadership calls down and says, you got to retract this paper, and they retract it. So, you know, these entities need to be investigated under the RICO Act, the Racketeering Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act, because, you know, you cannot be intentionally suppressing critical pharmaceutical safety data in an effort to, you know, maximize profits. You can't do that. That's illegal. And there really needs to be some investigations into that. And I'm aware, you know, the DOJ claimed last year that they are investigating that, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, what are the odds? What are the odds that throughout the whole peer review process of all these different topics, that one negative critique of a vaccine doesn't make it past a peer review process? Like, they're all perfectly fine. What are the odds that they're all perfectly fine is the inverse way to say that.
Right. Yeah. If you want to get a paper in the Lancet or New England Journal of Medicine, you're going to have to say, you know, right off the bat, COVID vaccines saved millions of lives. They were the greatest invention in history. And you can't say one bad thing about the shots. And so if you want to do that, yeah, you can get into those journals. But, you know, we were not going to delve that low into, you know, lying just to get in one of these, you know, corrupted journals. So thankfully, we've been able to identify friendly journals that are not compromised.
Yeah. Well, speaking of compromise, excuse me, maybe we'll end on this, because I know we've got about 5 minutes left. But I think many people, myself included, were very, very encouraged in the lead up to the election, particularly the sort of the combination of MAHA and MAGA, and everybody was expecting RFK Jr. to get in and really begin to fix the perverse incentives that exist among the regulators, big pharma industry, peer review process. And it seems like things are moving much slower than many of us would have liked it to move. What do you think is happening on Capitol Hill, and what is driving RFK Jr.'s relative inadequacy in terms of bringing forth the promises that he and Trump campaigned on?
Yeah, it's very, very slow, very disappointing. Unfortunately, we had some good things. You know, they shrunk the CDC recommended childhood vaccine schedule from like 80 doses down to about, you know, 30, 32. So, you know, they did do some good things there. But that's about it. You know, they're still giving the COVID shots to 6-month-olds. Yeah, they restricted the recommendations, but that doesn't spare the remaining millions of children. So we have that. And yeah, now they're not even talking about vaccines at all. Now, apparently, their strategy as they approach midterms is to just completely ignore them, not talk about them at all, and just talk about food. And so, you know, unfortunately, these political games will set us back another year, probably, of any, you know, actionable policy regarding these dangerous injections. So, yeah, I'm disappointed that politics takes precedent over public health.
Yeah. What would you recommend anybody who's listening to this who now feels passionate after hearing everything we discussed and they want to do something about it? Like, what can the common man do to affect change in the direction that they would like it to move in?
The common man can do two things. The first thing is to share all of these studies, share all of this information within your networks, with your family and friends, and help disseminate this information, because mainstream media does not cover any of it, none of it. And again, we've published the most shocking studies you could think of: genomic integration, vaccine being found 3.5 years later in a human. You know, the MMR vaccine deaths, none of it gets covered by any mainstream media, including Fox. You know, no, they're not covering this stuff, probably because they receive large sums of money from pharmaceutical companies with their foolish ads they always play, you know, saying, you know, take these, you know, drugs that nobody's heard of for a disease nobody's heard of. And then they, you know, list all of the serious adverse events. So, you know, you won't hear it there. But you will hear it on the alternative media and on social media platforms. So share it there. And then the second thing you can do, or actually there's three things. The second thing you can do then is to call, you know, your local representatives and, you know, tell them your concerns about these products and that, you know, you want, because that, you know, some of these lawmakers will listen to their constituency. And so raise your concerns to them. You can find their phone numbers online to their offices. And then the third thing is to just not be afraid of what other people will think of you when talking about this information. Right. So a lot of do what is right. Don't just be a sheep, right? Because a large proportion of the population were sheeps, including key individuals who made key decisions, we're in this dangerous and horrible situation. So people have to stop being afraid and do what is right. And for the next mRNA injection, the next booster, the next lockdown, the next vaccine passport system, don't comply. And if you don't comply, you don't take the next booster, then we will win in the end.
Yeah. Don't comply. I'm not sure if you caught up it over the weekend. It looks like they're trying to build mRNA back up. That guy, where was it, Australia?
The mRNA injection for his dog. Yeah, I wonder. I'd like to see the health status of that dog a year from now. You know, I doubt we'll see that, but, we'll see. Yeah. Now they're pushing mRNA for everything: cancer, chronic diseases, flu, all the other infectious diseases, bird flu. And so it's going to be a complete failure. There was already a mass experiment with billions injected. It killed millions of them. You know, so it's like, we already know that these are bad. They go into all your vital organ systems. These other platforms, they're not going to be any safer.
Yeah. Yeah. I caught that over the weekend. And I had some friends who have been highly skeptical with me, be like, oh my gosh, maybe it does work. I'm like, hey, this is some random story out of Australia about saving a dog using ChatGPT. I would have a bit of skepticism just taking that at face value.
Yeah, they're going to use that. They're rolling out, you know, the advertisements disguised as, or they're rolling out these, yeah, they're advertisements disguised as these, you know, miraculous claims. So watch out and be very, very vigilant.
Yes, be vigilant. We'll end it there. Nick, thank you so much for coming on. This was a great pleasure. And thank you for all the work you're doing. I think it's important that we have individuals like yourself out there on the front lines doing the research. And most importantly, like you said, not being afraid to let everyone know what you're seeing. Because I do agree. I think there is that mass psychosis, sheep-like mentality that is pervasive. And we just need a critical mass of defectors to say, you know what, I'm not afraid anymore. I'm going to talk about this because it seems pretty obvious to me.
Definitely, definitely. Well, thanks for having me.
All right, peace and love, freaks. Sticky. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free. Helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time, and until next time.